Bibles now and turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. We've been working through the book over the summer, and as we do that, I just wanted to comment on, I think I might comment every week on Mr. Brady's Baptist distinctives. I don't know as much about the history, but I'm a little more familiar with the doctrine, and I just want to make two things. Just right in the title is very important, and it's almost like we could, if you remember that, you'll know one thing. Two, not seven or eight. And they're ordinances, not sacraments. Okay? So there's Baptists believe in two ordinances. We know the first two anybody would, I think, the first two anybody would think of are baptism and communion. Other churches might call communion something else, the Lord's Supper, Eucharist, whatever. But baptism and the Lord's Supper, or baptism and communion, are the most well-known, probably because they're the only ones that are actually in the Bible. From the other things that people practice, the Catholics are the ones I think that have the most holy orders and holy matrimony, which of course, you're stuck if you're a Catholic because you can't have all the sacraments. You either have your holy orders, which is a commitment to celibacy, or you have holy matrimony, which is the opposite of celibacy. But anyway, two. Baptism and communion, and their ordinances. And in that sense, other churches might only practice two, but they will still perhaps look at them as a means of grace. And kind of the idea of a sacrament is that these things help us along to get grace. Now, I think something that we should remember is that we are blessed when we're obedient, and being baptized is part of being obedient, and partaking in communion is part of being obedient. So we do receive blessing from baptism and communion, but it's not some special type of grace, some additional saving grace or something. So that's why there are other churches that probably use these terms too, but Baptists in particular will say there's only two, and they're ordinances. They're not sacraments. So my little additional review just a couple minutes after you heard the lesson for the Baptist distinctives. Two ordinances. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. We're going to be looking this morning at a fairly familiar passage in Ecclesiastes. A lot of people, even people that don't really read the Bible that much, would hear this this passage and think, oh, I've heard that before, and be get some type of, encouragement or fuzzy feeling inside from hearing it. And in one sense, it's quite remarkable that, I do not know the Hebrew language, so I don't know what this sounds like in Hebrew, but it translates to be pretty poetic even in English, which is different from a lot of Hebrew poetry. A lot of the Psalms, we don't hear any poetry when we read this. We don't hear any rhythm or anything like that when we read the Psalms, which are mostly poetry. But here, for sure, there's this recurring meter, you might say, that we can definitely see there's some poetry here. But before we get into it, I want to just put us into this chapter. As we're thinking through the book of Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes might have been a bad choice for the summertime when we have so many different people here each week. We always have visitors, but there seems like there's more visitors, and there's part of our membership that's gone. And if you didn't catch it, you might not know where we are from week to week. So I'm going to try to bring us all together here to chapter 3 quickly. Have to do it quickly, right? We will get through Ecclesiastes by the end of the summer, Brother Sam. And then we'll slow way down and go back into Acts. Anyway, Ecclesiastes is written by the preacher. That's what the Bible calls him, and that's where I'm going to stay with that. He's a preacher. He doesn't have a name necessarily, or he doesn't give himself a name, doesn't identify actually his name. He calls himself the preacher, and I think he does that on purpose, because a preacher does something in particular. Most well-known activity that preachers do is preach, and they preach sermons. And so the book of Ecclesiastes, we're looking at it in the sense that the book is a sermon. Okay, so the preacher wrote Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a sermon, and his text, he gets right to his text after he says he's the preacher. And his text generally, or basically spoken, is that life doesn't make sense. When we look around us, when we look, in one sense, there's a phrase used in the book at least once or a few times. When we look under the sun, when we look around us, we know things that we've heard, whether it's religious teaching or just whatever. We look around and it doesn't make sense. Some things that we know should happen don't happen. Some things that shouldn't happen do happen. Sometimes we think somebody should be punished and they don't get punished. Just so much. You work hard and you don't see as much result from it as what you think you should get. And so he's looking and he sees that the world isn't perfect, basically. One of the sources that I've been using to help me think through what's going on is refers to this idea that we want life to be perfect. We kind of want life to be like it was in the Garden of Eden. And it's not. It's not going to be. Here under the sun. And why is that the case? Let's just make it the point clear. The case is because we're sinners. The immediate person was Adam with his wife Eve, but we're his descendants, and so we're sinners, so life is not the way it should be. But we look around, and Ecclesiastes is kind of pointing out how much it isn't like it should be. Look around in this area and that area and around, it's not the way it should be. But he has a point. This sermon is not an exercise in futility or despair or anything like that. He's bringing us to a point, and we'll even see. And last week we saw somewhat of a conclusion. This week we're going to see another conclusion. And throughout the book we see these partial, we might say, conclusions or hints toward the big idea. And in the end, of course, he's going to have a conclusion because it's a sermon. The difficulty we have here is that there's no way I could go through all 12 chapters in one 30-minute period and get it done. I can barely read it in silently in 26 minutes, so there's no way we could do that. And so then, so the difficulty is we jump into the middle, and we finish before we're at the end, and so I try to bring us up to speed, or up to the point where we are, and also try to give some conclusion, because some of you won't be able to be here next week or in following weeks. So, life doesn't make sense. It seems like there's no real meaning here under the sun. So, the question becomes, why am I here? Why am I here? What am I doing here? Because everything I do doesn't seem to make any sense. The things that I try to do doesn't satisfy the longing that's left in my heart. I'm left without meaning. What should I do here? How can I find meaning here? And the first place that he looks, that he points out, is that knowledge and learning by itself, and I think that's key for us as we go through, knowledge and learning by itself doesn't satisfy. Okay? You can say, well, I'm gonna learn as much as I can. I'm going to try to use that knowledge to the best of my ability. I'm gonna all of that, but knowledge and learning by itself doesn't satisfy. At the end of whatever we've learned, we find that we have even more emptiness. We learn more, much learning, not much, that's a different one. But you increase knowledge and you increase sorrow. So knowledge and learning by itself doesn't satisfy. Then he reminds us that pleasures, while they are enjoyable, so many different things that God has given us in the world that we can enjoy, and we can enjoy them, they do give joy and pleasure, but pleasures end. Whether it's entertainment type pleasure, right now is World Cup season, if you're a footballer, or soccer fan, you're sitting down, you watch a game, the timer ends. It gets to be 90 minutes, and it's not over. The referee says, oh, we got 3 more minutes to play. But it ends. And then, I mean, as much as you may have enjoyed the time, it ends. If you go on a vacation, you can't go on vacation forever. Whatever things that we enjoy and things that give us pleasure, they end. And when they end, we find that we're still not fulfilled. We're still missing something. It leaves us with a certain amount of emptiness. Then he points out that wisdom and learning is better than pleasures. Okay, so at the end of chapter 2, he says, live and enjoy the good because it's from God. And we should notice that he says, these things are from God, so we should live and enjoy them. And with that, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to those that are good. He even takes from the sinner to give to the good. And we see that. We might look around and say, oh, life, it's not fair and it doesn't work the way it should. But he sees, no, you know, this is what happens. So that brings us then to chapter 3 and another place that people look for meaning. Mankind, you and I, men, look for meaning in work, business, and labor. We're going to put those that together. They're kind of similar synonyms. You all know somebody, and now you probably know somebody that this doesn't apply to at all either, but we all know somebody that sinks their entire life into their work, into their job. I would say, and I think we would agree, that like wisdom is better than folly or pleasures, working is better to live for work than to live for pleasures. Working is better than folly in a similar way that knowledge and wisdom is better than folly. At least it seems that way. He doesn't say that necessarily here. But as I was thinking about it, since he compared the other, do you think it's better for a man to get a job and work a job and become successful at that job than to just kind of spend his living in pleasurable pursuits? Seems like it's better to work. Okay? But what do we know? If we're thinking along with this preacher, we know that at the end of that work, what do we have? Verse 9, what profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? Or what profit has he that works in that wherein he labors? Truly, people sink their life into their work. We know the workaholic. You know, he works at work, he works at home, he works on vacation. He might even work when he comes to church. Okay? As I was thinking about that, you know, technology has really enhanced that ability. Some of you have a smartphone, right? A dumb phone, as preacher would like to call it. But a smartphone, or we have this technology, and we're able to do our work at work, and then our work is able to catch us at home. We're driving down the road. And somebody can send us a message saying, hey, I need you to do this. Give me a call, or something like that. We're on vacation. We're supposed to be enjoying pleasures, and work is there nagging at us. I've done that. It's like, well, it's still enjoyable because I'm away from everybody asking me questions, but I need to set aside some time so that when I get back to work, there's less work to catch up on. Okay? But some people, that's all they do. They work. They live for work. They're a workaholic. I would say technology has also enhanced our ability to gain knowledge. It's also enhanced our ability to enjoy certain types of pleasures. So technology is not evil. It kind of just helps us along on the things that, whatever the place is that we're looking for meaning, it helps us get there, and it really helps us find out that there's not true meaning at the end of any of that. We as people, we want to be able to say, I built that. I picked that phrase on purpose, okay? A couple years ago, our president tried to tell people, you didn't build that. you had help from this person, and you couldn't have built it if it wasn't for this and that, whatever. And there was, I think, a somewhat appropriate response to say, no, I did build. I built this, you know. I worked hard, right? We feel like there's a sense of accomplishment there. I did something. Don't we as humans want to be able to say that? We do. We work to be able to accomplish something. We want to have a sense of accomplishment and a sense of meaning. And so this is a place that we look for that. And that's what the preacher is showing us. We look for substance, for meaning in these types of places. But as we look at this, and what we'll see is that there are many, but there's one tremendous limit to man's work efforts. There's a tremendous limit to it. And I might, and if we, so we're going to step back a little bit from this idea, and that tremendous limit is time. It's time. If you think of somebody's job or somebody's accomplishments or somebody working to build something or create something, time is a limit to that. Tremendous limit. Because everything has a season and a time. Verse 1 of chapter 3, to everything there's a season and a time for every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. You know, this is, I'm kind of being a little sarcastic here, but somebody born in the 1500s didn't have the opportunity to invent something that was, you know, the iPhone or, right? I mean, they were limited by time. They were not around at the right time to be able to do that. We're not, that's kind of an absurd illustration, but the point is the accomplishments that, let's say we as an outsider, we look at somebody who has accomplished something with a business or work and say, wow, if only I could be them. Well, not necessarily, okay? And that's the point. They happen to be in the right place at the right time. Time is a limit to certain things. There's a time to be born. There's a time to die. You ever heard the phrase, the idea? He died before his time. Okay. If he hadn't, what would he have done? What would he have accomplished if he hadn't have died? But there was a time to die. And it came before he accomplished what people thought he could. Does that mean his life had no meaning? Because he didn't have an accomplishment? There's a time to be born, a time to die. There's a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. There's a time to kill, and a time to heal. There's a time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones. That kind of gives the picture of somebody clearing a field out so that they can plant in it. A time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend or tear, and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. Let me point out here, this list doesn't say that one of them is good and the other is bad. In the way, in the sense of what happens on the earth and what people can accomplish with their work and their labor and how time and the things that happen in time affect those things, every one of those could be a good thing. I've heard that World War II made all the difference in the world. I think it was World War II made all the difference in the world for the Coca-Cola company. Maybe it was World War I. I don't know. But There's a war, and here's a company that was able to be established and profit from it. Now, people will say, blah, 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 whatever. But the point is, if you're looking at wanting to be successful, you're wanting to you say, I have built this. There's every single one of these things could be good for that, and every single one of them could be bad for it. Okay? And the point is, these things happen in time. They happen in time. And so time is a... Times sometimes help work, and sometimes frustrate work or business. Some things that happen in time promote and help and open up opportunities. Some things that happen in time hurt and frustrate opportunities. So there's all these times, and the point that is, I think the point that's being made is, everything has a certain time. There's a purpose, and there's a certain time for every purpose under heaven. That's what is said in verse 1. We work and labor, and we ought to, let me say. We work and labor, but we can put all of our life into a certain work and a certain labor. And what do we gain from it? It might be that all of our work and effort there's nothing tangible to show for it. There's not a business. There's not a bunch of employees. There's not a patent in a certain office. There's not a picture in a museum of the thing that we invented or discovered. What we see, though, is that God gives us this exercise. Look at verse 10. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. So we have this work, and God gives us work. God gives us work to do. God gave Adam and Eve work to do before everything was messed up in the Garden of Eden. And we still have this travail. God gives us work to do. And then he says, He hath made everything beautiful in his time. If we take some understanding, this is poetry, he makes everything beautiful in his time. When the time comes, when he says it's the time, it's going to work out. He makes things beautiful in his time. Sometimes that frustrates our plans. Sometimes that frustrates our plans. Sometimes that surprises our plans. Okay, somebody is... and again, in the realm of business, somebody says, well, I got an idea, I think this, and then all of a sudden the whole circumstances around change, and they go from being a little person that made this in their garage to having an empire, a business empire. Somebody else works hard, works hard, works hard, works hard. They've got a good idea, but they're before their time. And they never see anything. And 20 years later, somebody discovers what they said, and everything else is in place, and it's the time for that to come out. So this idea that everything has a time frustrates some. It surprises others. But all of this idea that we work for something, let's say everything worked perfect for you. You are the person that you worked hard, and it was the right time for the work that you did, and you were successful. He points out that even if you're successful, look at verse 11. He had made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he hath set the world in their heart. What is the world? Compared to a business, what's the world? It's huge. And in fact, another word that could be used for the word world there is the word eternity. Some people, you'll see that. You've heard that phrase, that we're created with eternity in their heart. Okay? Somebody is successful in business, and what do they find out? It still doesn't satisfy. It doesn't give that full meaning. Why? Because in their heart, there's more. The whole world is in their heart. So business, is frustrated in one sense by time, and that, but then in our hearts, even if we are successful, in our heart, there's eternity in our heart. The world is in our heart. There's more to life than work can accomplish, than the joy that accomplishing something in work can do. It leaves us still empty. And so then the question becomes, and this is something that I want to address, the question becomes, what do we do? This might be what we're kind of, what the idea that the preacher has. He brings this message in a certain way that really it makes you, okay, I get the point, but what do we do? What should we do? A fatalist will say, well, what will be, and it's kind of not, you know, I'm not going to do anything. It doesn't matter what I do, whatever, I'm just going to go along and do whatever. I can't think of the right name for it, but there's a certain mentality that says, I can change my destiny. Now, there's a certain amount of you ought to work hard to do something, but there's other people that think, well, that they're going to change the world around them. They're going to do it. God uses people to change the world, but some people are like, this can't be this way because my plans say it has to be different than this. Okay, that's not a fatalist. That's somebody that just is unsubmissive to the will of God and the way God works in this world. So what does a Christian do? Let's look at verse 12. Someone who believes in God and really does, he says, I know that there's no good in them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Okay? I think there's an important phrase there, and that is that the phrase, his life. His life. We shouldn't go around thinking about what we would do if we lived in a different time, or what we would do if the times were nicer to us, if the times were easier for us, or if the times were more, we shouldn't look in that sense. We should say, this is the time that I have been given. And here, the preacher says, there's nothing better. I don't know if he uses that phrase right there, but we should do good in our time. We have been put here. This life that I have, I shouldn't be a fatalist. I shouldn't say, well, it's just whatever. I should do right. I should do good in this time. This is the time that God put me in, and I will do good in it and enjoy it. Verse 13 says, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. We're put here. We should do good in this time. Some people are so concerned about doing some special, notable work for God that they do no work for God. They don't realize that God has placed them in a certain time to live for Him. Some people think, well, I can't live for God because I'm not the preacher. Well, God has put you in the steel mill, or God has put you on the farm. God has put you in the time for you. Your time is your work. Where you work is in the office, on a construction site. And so, in your life, where you find yourself, you should be living for God. That is one of the overarching themes that Ecclesiastes teaches us again and again. We look around us and things are bad. So what should we do? Give up? No. Can we change things? Well, we look around. We can't really change much. Over and over again, we see this and we see it should be this way and it's not that way. So should I be discouraged? Should I be defeated? No, I should live for God. I should do good in this time. I should fear Him. I know, verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it or added to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, or God does it, that men should fear before Him. So I'm going to do good. I should fear Him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. I will give an account to Him. So he says, I can look around. I can look and see that business and work and all of that, there doesn't seem to be much profit from it. Or there's some profit, but it's all hindered by time. Things happen that we don't expect. Some things, sometimes helping, sometimes hurting. What should I do? I should live. God has given me this time, these times, this world that I'm in. I'm not in the time when Jesus walked on the earth. I'm not in the time when Job was on the earth. I'm not working next to Noah. I'm not next to Martin Luther. I can learn from those things in the past, but I can't long to be there. I can't wish I'm somewhere else. I have this life that God has given me. I'm going to do good in it. And I'm using the word good because the Bible uses the word good, but I don't think, we kind of think do good means good works, you know, give to the poor, stuff like that. I think do good here means do what's right. Live for Him, fear Him, and realize, understand, remember that we're going to give an account for ourselves, as he points out. God requires that which is past. We're going to get to heaven, and our life is going to be past, and God requires something from it. And we ought to remember that. We can't say, well, I would have done better if I had been in a different situation. No, you're in this situation. Live for God in the place that you find yourself. Live for God with the life that God has given you. And don't wish for something else. Work. Enjoy the good of your labor. He's given us work to do. He's given us business to do, if we want to put it that way. It's a gift from Him. We're to enjoy it. And we're to live for Him in it. Wherever we find ourselves, that's work for Him. And we don't have time to continue. But that's a very important thing for Christian people to understand. If we don't understand that, we tend to think that the little things that I do, the only work that matters is work for God. Everything matters. Wherever God has placed you, it matters. That's how we've gotten to the place where we are right now in the world around us. In business, we've gotten to this point because Christians said, here I am, I'm going to live for God here. I'm going to work for God when I'm making this widget. And so, and we don't have time to go on to it, but it has tremendous cultural and national implications, and it'll have a big difference in your life if you realize this is where God's placed me, I'm living for God right here, and I'm going to enjoy what He gives me while I do that. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank You for Your Word, and we thank You that You have given us a purpose in our lives that we